And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels. It's Monday, February 8th. Derek Van Riper here with Eno Saris. Lots to get to on this episode. A flurry of moves after we recorded our Friday episode with Britt. Naturally, that's how it goes. You plan a podcast for midday. All the news happens late afternoon. A few days go by, and well, we're still excited to talk about it anyway. We're going to get to those news items and a story that Eno put together with Ken Rosenthal about some changes to the baseball before we dive into part two of our outfield preview. Eno, how's it going for you on this Monday?
It's good. It's good. I actually had a friend over.
What's that like?
Yeah, one friend. We watched the Super Bowl together, but because we hadn't seen each other in person for months, I don't remember a damn thing about that game.
You didn't miss anything.
I guess I missed all the, commercials, but
they're just commercials.
Yeah, right. There was a moment where in the past I've been like, I think I'm watching this from the commercials, and I yell at my kids when they're just sitting there slack-jawed watching like a E-Trade commercial. I'm like, what are you doing? Keep moving.
Well, I'm impressed by E-Trade's ability to rivet your children. That's getting them real young if they're getting 8 and 6-year-olds.
Moving images on a screen.
Flashing numbers by really quickly. Throw on some CNBC for your kids. They'll stare at that for hours. Let's get to some of the news. The game was a bust. I mean, look, even if you wanted the Chiefs to just keep it close, you were disappointed, right? I mean, you could love Tom Brady and say, I want Brady to win, but I want a good game. You didn't get a good game. You got the Brady win that you wanted. I was on the opposite side. The Chiefs were going to roll if any one of those teams was going to win easily. So I was just disappointed that we didn't get something more competitive. But Trevor Bauer lands in Los Angeles. And we thought maybe Anaheim, but the Dodgers come in 3 years, $102 million, I believe, with two opt-outs, one after each of the first 2 years of the deal. So the way it all stacks up, $40 million for Bauer in 2021, $45 million if he stays in 2022. And I assume if he's pitching well, he's going to opt out after that second year and go get more money than what he would get in that third year. So it is kind of the hybrid funky contract that we were expecting, but I didn't really see this coming at all because the Dodgers didn't strike me as a team that needed to go out and add pitching at all.
Yeah, I mean, when I ranked the rotations before all this happened and after the Padres trades, I had the Dodgers ahead of the Padres, even though the depth charts, you know, projections at the times had the Padres ahead. I just thought that the Dodgers had superior depth. And this was before they added Bauer. I thought with May and Gonsolin at the back there that, you know, no matter what happened, the front four, they went six strong and they were better equipped to deal with, you know, depth issues than maybe the Padres, who would have to then lean heavily on either Mackenzie Gore, unproven, Adrian Morahan, sort of weird fastball shape, but otherwise looks good. So I just really liked May and Gonsolin. I guess shed a tear for May and Gonsolin because I don't know. Now it looks like not only did they add another quality pitcher, but they added one that is known for bulk. And so now are May and Gonsolin just spot starters when Clayton Kershaw's back hurts? Or, you know, does Price hit the ground running or does he need some time and then they come in? But what's also hard is that May and Gonsolin at that period in their development as pitchers, where you're just not sure you know, how to use them, because you want to keep them stretched out because they're like they have starters arsenals. They had the ability to be starters, but the immediate need, the immediate best use for them would be in the bullpen. So you're kind of stuck trying to do what with what. I feel like if I had to make a guess, and this is a guess, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. My guess is that May stays in a kind of a bullpenish role, because they love that velocity and they love that sinker and that Blake Treinen-esque sinker, that, like, you know, that Bruce Dark Gratterall-esque sinker. They love that in the pen. And that Gonsolin is the guy that pitches in middle relief and pitches two or three, four innings at a time and tries to stay more bulkish. But I immediately pushed both those guys down from, I was high man on Gonsolin and May, maybe I was near the high man. I had them in the top 50. I pushed them back to 75, 80, because now they're 6 and 7 starters. They don't even have a role yet.
Yeah, I think what we have now is, it's a situation similar to what they used to have with Ross Stripling. You know, I think Tony Gonsolin is effectively the new Stripling. I would agree with you that I think he's more likely to be the long reliever, which gives him a quicker path to the rotation if someone gets hurt or is unavailable. And May probably works more in a 3, 4, 5, 6 out at a time sort of role. And they could always move May into the Gonsolin spot if Gonsolin goes to the rotation. And then if another starter goes down, May eventually gets there. But it definitely hurts both of them in terms of where you want to draft them and how you can roster them in different formats. I mean, if you think back to a couple years ago, if you played in a mixed league that was deep enough to roster Stripling, then you can still roster Tony Gonsolin. But putting him in that 70 to 80 range, maybe among starting pitchers, seems appropriate at this point. I think one thing that works in the favor of maybe both of these guys over the course of the season, doesn't help us from a fantasy perspective in the short term, outside of Bauer, every one of the Dodgers' other starters brings, I think, more than an average amount of injury risk between Kershaw, Buehler, Price, Urias. All four of those guys, I think, are above average in terms of their likelihood of missing some time. So it could be worse, but I do think with May in particular, he's really tough for me to draft right now, not knowing exactly how they're going to divvy up the roles. But based on what I expect to happen, I'm much more likely to take that chance on Gonsolin, stash him away, get some quality innings out of the bullpen, hope to vulture the occasional win, and inevitably, when there's an opportunity, he's going to fill it. I think the other thing that is kind of a bummer, just in terms of dreaming on the potential of Trevor Bauer, I wanted to see the chaotic start on short rest all season. You know, I wanted to see that. But the Dodgers, outside of maybe messing around with the schedule a little bit to give somebody else rest, probably aren't going to do that more than once or twice all season because of the depth they have. I mean, there are plenty of other places that Bauer could have gone, and there would have been an obvious need for him to be a higher volume starter. The Dodgers simply are not one of those teams.
Yeah, I can't imagine it. They could do something where they almost have a 6-man rotation, but Bauer's on a 4-man rotation.
I think the other starter would hate that, though, right? I mean,
well, if you could try to keep them all on regular, and Bauer goes on 4, I mean, because there's days off and stuff. Like, if you really, really wanted to manage the schedule, you could maybe pull something like this, where you say, you know, okay, who's it most important to? Okay, Kershaw and Price. You guys want to do it every day, every fifth day. You want to be like that. We'll keep you on that. Buehler, what do you want? Okay, you want to throw in some extra rest days? Okay. May and Gonsolin, you are now in the rotation, weirdly. You will pitch once every 10 days. And Bauer, you will pitch twice every 8 days. You could. I've seen some, like, people trying to skin that up, basically. But it's also asks a lot of the personnel. It ignores Kershaw, who's, like, I mean, you could say, okay, well, Kershaw's going to pitch every 5 days. That's fine. But it doesn't ask his input. I mean, maybe you could go to the pitchers and be like, are you guys interested in doing this? But I don't think you can sort of unilaterally force this upon them and just be like, well, Bauer's here, so he's pitching every fourth day, and you guys just fall in line, all right? That's not happening.
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned that you dropped Gonsolin and May in your rankings. Did you alter the ranking for Bauer with his move to the Dodgers, because a lot of pitchers, if they go to the Dodgers, the way they use pitchers, the way they develop pitchers, which is obviously a little less of an issue for someone his age, he's kind of already figured out some things for himself. Usually we look at going to the Dodgers as a positive coming from a lot of places. Did it move the needle at all for you with Bauer specifically?
No, I've got Bauer in the top 10, and I've seen some arguments for moving into the top five based on wins projections. You know, they should win. They should, you know, that bullpen should save you the games for him and continue, you know, like a good staff overall is good for the people within the staff too. I have Bauer's command number as the worst in the top 25. You know, wherever Tyler Glass now is. And so I think that matters. I think that that is a source of variation year to year beyond or that we've seen. We've seen it. We've seen it go from year to year. We've seen his walk rate oscillate. We've seen his home run rate oscillate. And even if, you know, he's found a new level of excellence, which I think he has. I think it's safe to assume that whatever he was doing last year to achieve those movement and velocity numbers, that he'll continue to do those next year. And if those movements and velocities are to be believed, then I believe he has some of the best stuff in the game. So I think he's now in a class with Yu Darvish. I think I put them as very similar. Have a lot of pitches, have a lot of movement, have decent velocity, don't always have the command.
Yeah, I think that gives you an idea of just how good things could go for Bauer. It just, I still find the 1.73 ERA in just 11 starts, I feel like that can be very misleading, right? If you're projecting him, you're probably coming in somewhere closer to, what, 3.60? ATC's got him at 3.67. Zips is 3.60. Steamer's 4.02. The bat's 4.01. So if you split it, 3.80 is kind of where you'd end up. I mean, I think he can probably come down a little bit from there.
I'd have a better number in my head just based on that stuff. There's been a large change in stuff, you know, in the last year. So he almost belongs with someone with a shorter track record, in my opinion. I understand that projections will call back, but I don't think that necessarily Bauer pre-slider is super relevant to Bauer post slider. And then to the same extent, I think that Bauer pre massive spin rates on his fastball is a little different than, you know, post massive spin rates on the fastball. So there's definitely a track record that isn't good, but I don't think that I think in pitching in particular, it's hard to reduce. Let's take the name off of it because the name is controversial to people. Let's talk about Yu Darvish. Yu Darvish has oscillated. He's had bad seasons. He's had good seasons. But now he's found this cutter, right? Mm-hmm. And the cutter seems to be a pitch that he can command. He can use as a fastball, basically, as a command pitch. How much of the bad do we have to bring in for Yu Darvish?
I think it's more almost injury risk than bad performances. Because I think the key difference for me, and maybe this is where a track record with different skills is manipulating my thought process too much. Darvish has the 4.95 ERA and the 1.43 WHIP in just 40 innings in 2018 as his ratio's outlier. Whereas mm-hmm. Bauer's got, what, 5 seasons with an ERA over 4? That's doing all the stuff that he thinks is important in training, right? That's him trying to push it and be at the forefront of technology. So I understand the argument that last year was different and, you know, with extra grip, with the pine tar, with extra spin, that is to some degree sustainable. I also agree with the premise that the projections are going to fail in an instance like that. But there's a big difference from the 2020 numbers to most of those pre-2020 numbers. And that's where it's so hard to make that decision. And I think when you're looking at price on both of them, they go right next to each other. They're among the pitchers that you're going to see at the end of round one, beginning of round two. Part of the reason I have a little more faith in Darvish too is that the walk rate has been excellent really since the middle of 2019. Like that skill, that was always kind of the missing piece with Darvish. It was the one flaw other than maybe some injury risk, and he's really done a lot to erase that. So I think you're right to put him in the same boat.
I have Darvish one ahead of Bauer, so I agree with you on a lot of things. And, you know, the market has spoken too. In some regards, they go right next to each other, Darvish and Bauer. But I allowed, since their command and stuff numbers were so similar, I know Darvish has a higher injury risk, but I did allow the projections to split the difference. I do have Darvish ahead of Bauer because the bat projected Darvish as the fourth best starter and Bauer as the 13th best starter. But I personally feel like they're closer together than that projection suggests. So, I mean, I guess I'm trying to walk the line of like agreeing with you sort of, but also trying to advocate a little bit that his stuff has changed.
I think what's going to happen though for me is someone will always get Bauer before I could get him at the end of round two, for example, right? If I think he belongs at the 2-3 turn, he goes to the 1-2 turn. I'm just not going to get him in snakes. Auctions will be different.
I generally am having a hard time biting on the second round starters. Like, I believe, actually, in the first round starters, DeGrom, Bieber, and Cole. Those are the only ones I believe in. Bueller, you know, is my second round pick for a starter. I can see some discussion to be had about how many innings he'll pitch with everybody, but also with Bueller in particular because, A, they have built in ready to go guys like Gonsolin and Amay to give him the blow when he needs to. B, he's had blister issues. See, he hasn't like built up necessarily the perennial 200 innings pitched kind of workload in his past. I think in a season where all of the workloads will be reduced, his 160 or so innings pitched will be just fine. And so I'll take him fourth. But then when you get to you know, Castillo, Darvish, Bauer, Giolito, and I'm the high man on Woodruff. I'd rather just wait to see which one of those guys made it to me in round three, I think.
So it's pretty interesting. It's not like you and I sit down and go, where are you going to put Woodruff? Like I had him at six among starters when I put out rankings.
I had him that high, and then I just felt embarrassed and like by the market. I got embarrassed by the market to push Woodruff down to nine. I had him at six at some point.
Well, it goes to the point, though, that there's not much separating SP5 from SP13. I think, you know, Giolito for me is at five, Nola's at 13.
I think the top three are their own tier. They seem like very solid. Bieber, DeGrom, and Cole. Like, they're just very solid pitchers. You know, no red flags. Then, yes, I agree with you. That sort of 4 through 14, 15. I mean, from Luis Castillo to Jack Flaherty, I think I had Luis Castillo and Jack Flaherty ranked right next to each other last year. You know, and now they describe a 10-pick drop. That's another sort of tier for me. And then when you start talking about Carrasco, for me, other people have him higher, but like Snell, Hendricks, Berrios, those are like second pitchers, third pitchers.
Yeah, clear twos and threes for sure.
Yeah,
Flaherty, I think, is interesting for me just because I see the results from 19 and 20 put together, 312 ERA, 101 whip. That whip puts him fourth among starters during that span.
Backed by Command Plus, like he definitely has great command.
Yeah, and you don't have the 33%+ K rate that you're going to get from DeGrom, Cole, or Bieber, but you're right in line with the near 30% K rate that we've seen from Bueller and that we've seen from Woodruff, right? And you're getting a slightly better walk rate than we've seen from Lucas Giolito to this point, and you're getting a guy that's in a very pitcher-friendly environment on a team that got a lot better by adding Nolan Arenado too. So with Flaherty, I mean, I know he hasn't done everything all at once over a full season, and maybe I'm just buying way too much into the second half in 2019 when he was just totally lights out and ridiculously good, but he's in my top 10, definitely one of the guys I'm targeting if the top, you know, four or five are all off my radar because of where I'm picking in the order or because of how things break in an auction. We got one mailbag question about Gonsolin from Ryan. Do you think I should try to trade Gonsolin now in a keep forever dynasty league targeting someone like Austin Meadows, or should I hold on? My thought is if you get a player like Meadows for Gonsolin, you're doing really well. You're kind of buying low on Meadows, you know, top 30-ish overall sort of player this time last year, still young. With Gonsolin, I think as much as you like Amino, and as much as I can see him becoming a top 30, top 40 type starter with the opportunity, we may have to wait a year or two before that happens. And some of that's opportunity, but some of it's also a few of the flaws we saw in the postseason too, right? I mean, I think we saw that he's not necessarily locked in to being that good start over start, outing by outing just yet.
I just changed my ranks. You convinced me a little bit on Flaherty. I moved him up a little bit.
I made a compelling argument. I'm happy to have done that.
I think if it was on the table for me, Meadows for Gonsolin, I'd take Meadows.
Yeah, I think you're getting enough of an upgrade there where it's worth it for sure.
Is it a good time to sell him generally? No. I think that would be a good return to get Meadows right now. I think that that's probably off the table. In fact, before my ranks came out, I identified a bunch of players that I was going to be higher on than consensus and made offers in a couple of my dynasty leagues on all those players. And one person had Urias and Gonsolin on the same team, and talks died really quickly because they just said, no, I need them this year or whatever. It's funny. Urias and Gonsolin, I might have paid a lot. glad I didn't do that.
Yeah. Timing is everything. But thanks a lot for the question, Ryan. That's definitely the type of trade you should make if it is available to you in a dynasty league right now.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let's talk about Marcell Ozuna. He goes back to the Braves, I guess by default with a free agent. A lot of times, if I think there's a good chance they're going to return to the team that they previously played for, I don't really move them to a different spot. Like, what I'm saying is I don't assume a better or worse environment. I assume the same environment, and we got that in the case of Marcell Ozuna. Maybe things get messy in 2021 if we don't get the universal DH, because if Ozuna has to play in the field, then Austin Riley can maybe get squeezed for playing time. But I still think we're going to have the DH, so I'm not sweating that all that much. I think Ozuna, we talked about him a little bit on our episode last Wednesday, part one of the outfield preview. He just kind of falls into this range where you're kind of choosing the masher hitter that doesn't run at all. And that player group seems a little bit undervalued in snake drafts as people push speed up in the draft order a little bit. You know, the Luis Roberts and the Randy Arozarenas sometimes get pushed ahead of guys like Marcell Ozuna, who can do pretty much everything except for steal bases for us.
Yeah, it's funny to see that Ozuna stole 12 bases in his free agent walk year with the Cardinals. But then on the 1 year deal with the Braves, he didn't take one chance. I was gonna well, what if you know, people in free agent walk years steal more bases? That would be interesting. But he's kind of a one man refutation to that. I tend to believe that two things, that he conquered some sort of slice that he had. There was a time when he was barreling the ball at sort of 9 to 10% of the time and wasn't getting the results that you'd expect because there was something a little bit off with his barrels. And it may have been some interaction between how he hit the ball and his home park, because he's, you know, before Atlanta, he'd never really hit in a home park that was neutral. So I think there's some sort of coming together of barreling the ball the most he's had in his career, getting rid of a bit of a slice in there, and then also playing in the friendliest home park that he's been in. All those things kind of seem sustainable. So I don't know. It's interesting to me that the bat is the low man on his ISO. But still gives him 35 homers. I think if you take the steals away that he projected, I think something like 280, 35, 36 homers and a couple steals should be easy for him to do.
How about this? Better 2021 season from a fantasy perspective. George Springer with the move to the Blue Jays or Ozuna staying in Atlanta?
I'm going to go with Springer. I think because Springer, he gets a little bit of a homer boost, but I just think he'll steal more bases. And I think there's a tiny, tiny bit of injury risk around Ozuna that is hard to kind of nail down, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think straight up from me, and this is probably Derek Cardi's tweets getting into my head a little bit too much, I'd still take Springer over Ozuna. Again, I kind of ranked Ozuna assuming Atlanta was the most likely place he'd end up, and I didn't have to bump him up as a result of that move. They were right next to each other before, and I think they're both relatively good values. I'm thinking back to something you said last week, at least I think it was one of the episodes last week too, where when a player returns to his team as a free agent, the production doesn't seem to tail off as much, right? It seems to be a better investment for the team. It seems to work out better because that team knows the player really well and decided to bet on that player's longer
term. That's an old Matt Schwartz finding. I don't know how it applies when it's not been your player since day one. I think some of that was kind of extensions and stuff. And then on top of it, like, I think it was written kind of around the time that Ryan Howard got extended. So it's obviously not something you can nail down all the way. But, they have access to the medicals, so they've seen whatever it looks like on the inside of the shoulder. They've seen his day-to-day work habits, and they re-upped for one of the more impressive contracts that they've given out, that this current Braves regime has given out, right? This is the Braves regime of one-year deals. So they made a bet on this guy in particular. That could be a good sign.
Yeah, I think they just expect him to mash over the life of that deal. And after the CBA, for sure, of course, he'll be a regular DH for them. But I would not be at all surprised if Ozuna can reach those projections. You're looking at low to mid-30s home run totals. You're looking at 100 RBIs pretty much across the board, 90-plus runs scored, and a good batting average to go with it. So absolutely a good core player to have. Going right around, was going in the 45 to 50 range in a lot of drafts before re-upping with Atlanta. Maybe he ticks up a couple of spots in ADP as we get closer to March, but I don't think he's going to jump up all that much.
You've got, I thought, I would have guessed, do you know, are you looking at it? Which one of these is younger than the other?
Ozuna's younger than Springer, yeah. I think.
Is that not at all surprising to you?
Springer went to college, though, that's why. No, it's just because Springer was a UConn college guy.
But despite that, I think I'm calling for Springer to age better. And I have some evidence for that. You know, basically sprint speed. We've talked about that a fair amount.
Yeah, playing up the middle is a big part of that, right? I mean, if you're playing center field as opposed to a corner outfield spot, that generally projects to age more gracefully. Your athleticism should hold on.
Springer was 83rd percentile for running last year. So that's pretty good. Ozuna, without looking, I can say, was not.
What do you think he was? I wonder if he's one of those guys that's faster than we realized.
What do you think Ozuna was? I should be fair.
Hey, I got torched by Clint Frazier's defense last week. I said there's no way he'd be the kind of guy you'd think could be a finalist for a gold glove. And I looked, I was like, oh, wow, he's actually good based on outs above average last year.
Well, there was
the
whole thing that he couldn't. The idea was that his eyes were moving, that he's a heel striker, like he runs on his heels, and that was bugging his eyes out when he was trying to catch the ball. Who knows if any of that's true? 62nd percentile for Marcel's 58th percentile, but hey, that is better than I would have expected. Actually, when I think of Ozuna, I think of just like slow and plodding, basically. So 58th percentile. Maybe he'll age better than
I thought. Is kind of in like a steady decline. Yeah. Check it out, though. If you go back to 2016, 76th percentile. 2017, 72nd percentile. 2018, 69th. 2019, 63rd. And then 2020, 58th. So he's losing a little bit every year, but that's normal for the type of player that he is. As long as he's not in the 25th percentile in a year or two, you know, he'll be fine.
Yes, the warning signs come out in the sort of 20th, 10th percentile. That's when defenses start playing you differently. But this is still a good proxy for athleticism. And the state of athleticism with Azuma is just slightly lesser than the one for Springer.
We got one more topic, transaction related, to get to. The Rangers and A's hooked up on a trade. Elvis Andrews now has a place to play. Chris Davis ends up in Texas. Jonah Heim goes to Texas as part of that deal. This is a pretty cool trade, though, because it unlocked a lot of things for most of the major league players involved. I mean, I think Chris Davis might actually hurt Willie Calhoun's opportunities to play now that he's a Ranger, but Elvis Andrews was going to be more of a utility guy, maybe the favorite to start at third base, at least to begin the season in Texas. And now Oakland's going to try and just squeeze at least one more productive defensive season out of him at short and lean on him heavily as their replacement for Marcus Semien. Because I looked at the organizational depth chart, you know, there's really no competition for playing time at shortstop as it stands right now for Elvis Andrews.
Yeah. He's not super compelling in any other way.
Yes, a lot of other things have eroded as it pertains to Elvis Andrews' skill set. Yeah.
You know, we're just stuck on the sprint speed thing, so I kind of want to just, I'm going to run it through for these guys because it's kind of interesting. Chris Davis had the hip injury, and he was never fast, but he was 40th, 50th percentile before the hip injury, and the last 2 years, he's gone down to 24th and 19th percentile sprint speed with the hip injury. So and then you put that in the hand in hand with his barrel rates, his batting Statcast numbers, and see that his barrel rate went from consistently in 14 to 17% to 10% in 2019 to 8% in 2020. So you see this like maybe athletic sloughing off that's happening, right? You know, his K rates and walk rates don't tell the story, but there's still something in the quality of contact and his ability to run. And of course, you'd make a bigger deal out of this, except that Elvis Andrews has the same problem on his end, and it's more important, maybe possibly, because it's affecting his fielding. Elvis Andrews went from the 72nd percentile in 2015 to 35th percentile last year. So that would make him one of the slowest shortstops. It says here 43rd fastest shortstop in the big leagues. I have a feeling that he's not going to steal 25 bags.
I don't think he will either, but he was 46th percentile in sprint speed in 2019, and he still stole 31 bases that year as a 30-year-old.
That's a good point.
So, I mean, he's risky because of his age and because of the physical deterioration of his best tool at this point. I think it's fair to say that. But the other weird thing with Elvis Andrews, he doesn't strike out that much. He's always been good at putting a lot of balls in play, and he's kind of quietly increased his average exit velocity from where it was pre-2019. So there's stuff that's been kind of going the wrong way for him. There's a couple little things that have gone the right way. I don't think he's going to be a good real-life player. I think he might be a surprisingly useful fantasy option now that he's unlocked a lot more playing time following this trade. So I don't know if you're going to want him in like a 10-team mixed league or anything like that, but if he hit 7 or 8 homers and stole 18 bases this year with a decent batting average, that wouldn't surprise me. He's probably stuck in the bottom third of the lineup, though, with the A's. If you think back to Elvis Andrews at his peak, those are some rebuilding Texas teams where he was pretty high up in that order.
Yeah. I think you might be right. I think he might be a fairly to really good mono league pickup, like an AL only play. I could see that because they don't really have a great other option. That's another way of looking at things in terms of like who's going to play instead of him. The only person I can think of, if people want to go the prospect route, is Nick Allen. There's not much information on him, but he did get an invite to spring training. And he last played in high A in 2019 and was 22% better than league average there. So good walk and strikeout rates and stuff. And then apparently was dealing at the alternate site. So that's the sort of dynasty, you know, possibility angle. But on the current roster, I don't really see an A that should take the jaw away from Andrews. I don't think Machine, although he has a top level name. I mean,
it's a plus name.
Why wouldn't you want a Machine at shortstop? But I don't think that Machine really has the bat, and I don't think Chad Pinder has the glove. Sheldon Noisy also, I don't think, has the glove. So you don't really have a ready-made solution if Andrews doesn't work out.
I think there's a couple of ways, though, that the A's are a little more interesting right now. Second base is wide open. Tony Kemp, to me, is just a nice bench player. He's not a guy that should play all the time. So Sheldon Noisy could end up playing a lot at second base. If you want to be excited about him, look at what he did at AAA in 2019. I think he's one of those guys that could offer a lot of cheap power and maybe have a bigger role than expected. Then I would say Austin Allen. If you're in a two-catcher league, they got Aramis Garcia back from the Rangers as part of the trade. He was a backup in San Francisco for a couple of years. He has some power, a lot of swing and miss in his game. I think Allen's more interesting, though.
Injury history for Garcia, too. So I think he could end up starting the year on the DL or something. I mean, he's coming off of a shoulder thing.
Yeah, it's like Allen was a player they acquired in the Jurickson Profar deal last winter, and they've got the DH spot unaccounted for now with Chris Davis. So whether they're going to go out and, I think I saw people on Twitter saying Edwin Encarnacion would fit really well there.
I mean, that's something that the A's have been doing for years. You know, right? Like, they had mm-hmm. Frank Thomas. Do you remember that? They had Frank Thomas and Mike Piazza, dude. They love picking up the game. So I think that's, I don't even know. I have no inside knowledge, but yes, I think Edwin Encarnacion is going to be an A. I think that's our a lock. You want to put it down. Yes, what happens at second, I think, is potpourri. It's sort of throw them all out there. And I think Nick Allen could be in it for that. So you're talking about Nick Allen, Sheldon Noisy, and Tony Kemp being the sort of fallback plan. And the reason you don't want Tony Kemp is it's a minus-minus bat. You know, he'll get on base, and that's it. And he's a guy who can get on base confidently. He'll be above replacement. He might be a one-win player, but two wins is where you're trying to get. That's league average production, and they're trying to get there on the super cheap. So, in any case, I think the other wheel winner might be Jonah Heim.
Yes, I like Jonah Heim quite a bit. I think you've got pretty low K rates. He switch hits, so it's possible that he could take over the larger share of the playing time behind the plate in Texas. There's a little bit of power in that bat. Just the kind of catcher that might actually play a lot and not hurt you, which is nice to have in the pool. I think some people really like Sam Huff. Huff made the leap from high A to the big leagues during the shortened season. He has a ton of swing and miss in his profile. If I'm sitting here 1,000 miles away from the Rangers' decision-making process, it certainly makes a lot of sense to send Sam Huff down to double A or triple A, at least to begin the season before bringing him up. And even if Huff does end up on the big league roster, I'm not sure he's necessarily a two-thirds or three-quarters share of the playing time sort of catcher. I think Heim's actually much better off here because with the A's, Sean Murphy was going to catch, 110, 120 games, so Heim was going to get 40 or 50. At least in Texas, it could be an even split, if not something that favors Jonah Heim at this point.
Yeah, and I think the another way of saying it, because I'm agreeing with you, is that Huff has more upside if he puts it all together. He has more offensive upside. So therefore being, 23 years old and having more upside, that seems like an argument for getting it all together in the minor leagues while they play the guy with less upside at the beginning. The other thing that I can add to this discussion is that pitchers have told me they love throwing to Jonah Heim. So, if there's any sort of question about Sam Huff's defense abilities, game calling, that sort of deal, then, with a minor league season in place, that seems, like an easy way to go about things. Either way, I think a guy who makes a bunch of contact like Heim does and is easy to throw to, Eric Longenhagen also made the point that he's a 6'4 catcher and a switch hitter and a catcher, and that all three of those things often lead to late breakthroughs. So if you're looking at the projections and not feeling it, just do some mental math, add 50 points of ISO, and see how it looks then. Now you could be talking about a guy with a 240, 250 batting average, and, you know, depending on the play, but like in full season play for a catcher, probably like 20 homers. Mm-hmm. That could be really interesting. So none of the depth charts, projections, none of that really captures all of that. So could be a good play in deep leagues.
The last thought here is just the Rangers depth chart being a bit more crowded now. When you start to look at all the different positions there, if they were to go something like Dahl, Tavares, and Gallo left to right in the outfield, that means Willie Calhoun and Chris Davis are working in some kind of tandem or battling for spots as the DH. I mean, Calhoun is a lefty, Davis is a righty. Maybe they platoon out of the DH spot initially. Maybe if there's an injury in the outfield,
be so Calhoun. Sad for a 26-year-old to be with Calhoun's track record. I still think he has the upside. I think it would be kind of sad to platoon him, but at least he's a lefty swinger. And I think with Dahl being so often hurt, I think you're basically talking about Dahl, Calhoun, Davis for two spots.
Yeah, that's probably how it goes.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get to our next item real quick, the changes to the baseball. I haven't even seen this story yet. You were telling me before we started recording that you and Ken Rosenthal had a piece that went up on Monday. What is going on with the baseball now?
Yeah, it was a thing this weekend. you're never really fully off the clock. But, you know, so what's different about what's happening now? So baseball is actually announcing a change to the ball, basically. And they did it internally, but when they do a memo like this, they have to know it's going to be leaked, right? So they sent a memo to general managers and equipment managers basically saying the ball will be slightly deadened this year. And the reasoning for it is they have a very long sort of wide range for the coefficient of restitution. So that's the bounciness of the ball. They have a wide range. In fact, when I was looking, I was really surprised because it's much wider than the range used in the KBO. And so they have this wide range and, you know, the ball has been bouncy like on the level of getting closer to the high end of the range, you know? That's fine because it's within the range, but you know, Rawlings said that they found a way to change the way the ball was constructed so that it would more reliably show up in the midpoint of this range, and that might lead to less variation year to year in terms of what we see on the field in terms of bounciness of the ball and so on and so forth. Nowhere in this discussion or this email or in any of discussions with baseball has anyone told us what the drag implications will be? And the way the ball has flown, drag versus the way the ball bounces, the core, has also wildly oscillated the last few years. It's been the major difference between groundbreaking seasons like 2019 when we broke all the home run records, and then sort of, you know, 2018 took a step back, you know, 2017 we broke them the first time. So it's hard to know, you know, if this is just another year where it'll be different on that level, or if they deaden the ball so much that we're going to go to like 2014 pre-live ball. But from the numbers they gave, from the sense that they gave, they said, you know, 1 to 2 feet off of a 370-foot fly ball, that's what they would lose. If you do that sort of math and you go back and you look at what's happening, I've been told that we're going to lose maybe 5% of the home runs in baseball. You know, that we're talking about sort of a 3 to 5% drop in home runs. We're going to notice that. You know, I think that the ball will be noticeably deader. It's going to have some effect on drag because they changed the properties of the ball. So it's possible the ball, you know, has less drag and flies better, but bounces less good and stays about the same. But I just think it's notable, for one, that they're announcing this basically, they're trying to be transparent in their own words on this situation. And yet, there's weird process stuff. They didn't talk to the rules committee about it because it's not a new ball. But they did talk to the competition committee, and is another weird thing is like Rawlings made a bunch of these balls, and baseball was like, whoa, no, we got to test them first. Well, baseball owns Rawlings, so why is baseball in the memo? It says we had to direct Rawlings not to use these in the games. Why did you have to? You are Rawlings.
Yeah, that's strange.
Why did Rawlings make you a bunch of balls and you told him, no, we can't? What? So as they are more transparent, there's still questions about the process that they've underwent. And the major question for us, I think the major question in fantasy in particular is just what is this going to do? I tried to take a list. I took the list of people projected by the Bad X to hit more than 25 homers. And then I sorted them by the shortest home run distance. And number one is Didi Gregorius. And I, in fact, think that he's the sort of player that would get hurt the most. You know, guys who hit 25 homers by sneaking it over the wall in certain places, right? That requires the ball is lively. They're in the certain place. You know, we've talked about this before, Didi, right? Like his homer production is very tied to what parks he lives in. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that Didi's up there. So that 25 homer projection, you know, if you apply a 5% reduction in homers across the board, then you're not going to take more than a homer or two away from him. But maybe he actually only ends up with something like 20 homers this year. But the rest of the list, not as obvious. Anthony Rizzo, Ketel Marte, Mike Yastrzemski, Anthony Santander, Francisco Lindor, Mike Moustakas, CJ Krohn, Kyle Tucker, and Kyle Seager. So there's some darlings on that list, you know. Yastrzemski also sticks out because one of the things that they did during COVID was close the windows in San Francisco on the floor. There was like these places where you could just be walking along the park and you can just look in. Do you know about this?
I've seen them on TV, I think, yeah.
Yeah, there's some parks that do this where just have a little bit of a place where you didn't have to pay for a ticket. You can see, you can't really see that well, but you can, you know, see some ball for free, basically. They had closed those off because they didn't want people congregating there. So when they closed those off, it changed the wind. And that, along with the new walls and the reduction in Triples Alley, you know, that could have been fueling a lot of Yastrzemski's power. Now the ball is deadened, and post-COVID, are they going to open up those windows again? Are they opening up those gates so the air can go through? And if that happens, will we see a larger reduction in power? I would mentally reduce Yastrzemski's projected home runs down to that sort of 22-23 level, I think. So those are some guys that I thought should be highlighted in this situation.
It's a really interesting way of looking at it because, yeah, I would agree that I don't think everybody's going to be equally impacted by this. Alex Bregman pulling the ball the way he does might be, you know, more impacted as well. Just think of other types of players.
He's on the top 25. Yeah, Bregman's there. Jose Ramirez.
What, LeMahieu?
Eddie Rosario. Not LeMahieu for some reason. That is surprising. Where is LeMahieu?
Is he short on the home runs? He might not be on the list because the projections
are under.
He might
not be projected for 25.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he didn't get in my list. But, you know, Marcus Semien, Eddie Rosario, Cody Bellinger is 16th on shortest home runs. Reese Hoskins, 15th on shortest home runs. Eloy Jimenez. So... apparently there's a small bias in the data for people who play in parks with short home run, short walls distances, because I think sometimes the distance is marked as like sort of like over the wall, you know? So it's not that distance is not as hard a stat as maybe people want it to be.
Yeah. It's a little more subjective than it really should be.
In StatCast, it's listed as projected home run distance, just to give you a sense.
Lead to some issues here and there, but really interesting stuff. We'll be sure to link that story up in the show description so people can check that out. When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, Nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary nano experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Let's get to part two of our outfield rankings. We left things off kind of in the 125 to 150 range. We'll kind of pick things up there. Mostly, as you get past the 150 range, you're just looking to fill certain categories. That's the best thing about the outfield each and every year. No matter what you are looking for, you can probably find someone who helps you in any one of the five categories, and some players that might actually help you in three or four of the five categories as you move even further down the list in the outfield. For me, that's one of the cases against having too many outfielders in your early round foundation, because you might need the flexibility of addressing any one of those categories by filling out multiple spots in your outfield with someone who steals bases or someone who hits for average and scores lots of runs because of where they hit in their lineup, right? No matter what you need, you can generally find it there. First question for you, you know, as you start to look at the back half of the draft, or at least after those first 10 rounds, do you have any obvious value outfielders that you've been targeting very heavily or that you're planning on targeting very heavily as we get further into draft season?
There's a couple different categories. One is good and young and probably fine. So, like, you know, projected bounce backs from people like Austin Meadows, Jock Peterson. Jock Peterson's Statcast numbers were fine last year. So, you know, that if the projected bounce back comes from a younger player, then I'm into it. And then there's the projected bounce backs I don't believe necessarily. But the price has become so low on these players that I end up with them, which is, you know, Mitch Haniger, I think he is young enough that he's in between these two groups, but, you know, also older, where you wouldn't want to just take his projected bounce back as gospel, especially after two surgeries and, you know, basically 2 years off. But he's super, super cheap. And then Justin Upton, I'm not banking on anything from him, but he costs zero. I got him in a best ball as my eighth outfielder, I think. It was a 12-team league, but still, that's a very low cost. And as far as I can tell, he's going to start as long as he's healthy.
Yeah, I think in leagues with at least 14 teams and five outfielders, definitely makes sense. I think you start to get into a tricky spot, like in a 12-teamer, especially a 12-teamer where you only have three starting outfield spots. I don't know if those leagues are deep enough to value what he brings to the table, but he should hit probably, what, fifth or sixth in that lineup. He still has power. There's some batting average downside, but we draft similar players 100 picks earlier, 200 picks earlier in some cases. So I do think Justin Upton still has something left in the tank. I think the Angels making that deal to add Dexter Fowler is probably a little signal they're going to give Joe Adell as much time as he needs in AAA, which is kind of disappointing, but it's not totally undeserved either. I mean, I think you want to be able to keep things afloat until he's ready and not have that added pressure to bring him up before he's clearly figured out AAA pitching.
Yeah, and Fowler won't block him if he takes off, you know? I think Fowler's a good enough player to start the season with, and a bad enough player to quickly transition to sort of fourth, fifth outfielder style if Adell comes up.
Yeah, so I think as you look at the beginning of this group, Dylan Carlson is one of those guys who's carrying a pretty steep price tag. It was not quite the rookie season that I expected from him last year. There were definitely some growing pains. But you look at the Cardinals at the very end of the year, where they were hitting him in the lineup, how little they've done to add to their own outfield. makes you pretty confident they believe he's going to be a big part of their plan, not only in 2021, but obviously much longer. The projections are okay, not great. 19 home runs, 10 stolen bases from the Bat X, a 246, 318, 414 line. But this is a broken record sort of position for me. When a player comes up and debuts and strikes out a lot and doesn't walk a lot and puts up an ugly slash line over a partial season, the projections generally don't look that good. I think factoring that in for Dylan Carlson, 19 homers and 10 steals actually is a pretty good projection. And I think there's a very good chance that he goes over on every one of those slash line numbers, over 246, over 318, and over 414 right away in 2021.
Yeah, I think the evidence is that his projected strikeout rate is higher than it would have been at any level in the minors, and except for back at rookie ball, basically. That the translation of AAA strikeout rate to major league strikeout rate these days is almost a 1-to-1 situation. And he had like 22.8% strikeout rate in AAA, not a lot of PA, but he was there on that one. And then on top of that, his ability to discern balls and strikes is pretty good. He already had a better than average reach rate in his first season. And that's a good sign. He's not a free swinger, and I actually like that. I'd like seeing 40% swing rates and 24% reach rates. That does not seem to suggest to me that he's going to strike out 30% of the time. So I think the strikeout rate will be a big portion of his breakout. Once he starts getting that down, the balls will fall, the power will come. I think he can now produce those projections. I just also enjoy watching him. And I think that he's got a little bit of a sense of when to push and pull, and, that he's got adjustability in there. So, the soft scouting type stuff, I think, favors him. So the one problem is like, what's his ADP? You're saying that it comes with a cost already.
Right. He's going around pick 150. So he's the 41st outfield eligible player off the board in NFBC leagues. It puts him next to Michael Brantley, who has, I think, a very safe batting average floor, lots of run production. Not really going to steal much for bases at this point in his career.
Like, you want those 10 steals.
Yeah. And here's the other one, like another kind of would you rather: Dylan Carlson for 2021 only, or Anthony Santander? Like, obviously, keeper and dynasty, we've been miles ahead with Carlson for a while, but when someone like Santander exceeds expectations and gets to play in a very hitter-friendly environment and does show some interesting skills growth, I mean, look, shortened season or not, cutting your K rate from 21% to 15%, that will get my attention. And we're not talking about a guy that in the last two seasons combined has swatted 31 homers in 130 games. So I think he's
love that home park.
A little bit of a flawed player, but everything kind of lines up for him to get all the opportunities to continue playing every day in a pretty good situation in Baltimore.
Yeah. And even if you take a homer or two off for them being short, having a full 600 plate appearances in Baltimore, sign me up, man. Even if I think Trey Mancini hits too many ground balls, I'm signing up. Like, getting hitters in Baltimore is, and also like getting fringe hitters for cheap in Baltimore. Like, remember Renato Nunez? Like, this usually works out. So I might take Santander there. The projection also is a powerful argument for Santander. The bat gives him a top 40 outfielder designation with $11 and puts Carlson, by those projections at least, as more of a 55th ranked outfielder. Lot of space in between the two. And though I think Carlson can outperform those projections, you're asking him to outperform those projections by $5, $4. And that's just putting that means you're paying $11 and maybe getting $11. Whereas you paying $11 for Santander, you might also get $13. That's how the variation goes. So I'll take Santander there. Carlson over Brantley. I'm taking Brantley too. So as much as I like Carlson, the price is pretty high on that.
Yeah, there's a good chance there's someone else I like more still sitting on the board when I have to get Carlson. So I could see myself ending up with him in auctions, but not in snake drafts. I mean, I've got Kyle Lewis, who goes about 15 picks ahead of him. I've got him just ahead of Dylan Carlson for 2021. Ian Happ's in this range. I think Ian Happ is going to put up numbers that are just as good with probably a little more power this year than Carlson. So that's where I think Happ has a little bit of a short-term advantage. I've got Brantley a decent amount ahead of Carlson for 2021 only. I think some of the injury risk that Michael Brantley had a few years ago has faded. He's not high risk anymore. He's more of like medium risk. And I think with the run production and the difficulty of finding good sources of batting average in the middle of middle and late rounds, that makes me very interested in Michael Brantley in this range too.
You know, and another thing is there's a group of players that Carlson is in that represent about the same opportunity to outperform their projections, about the same age and job opportunity, and even about the same homer and stolen base potential combination as Carlson. And those names are Nick Senzel, Kyle Lewis, and Raimel Tapia. So if you've got a list with Nick Senzel, Dylan Carlson, Kyle Lewis, and Raimel Tapia on it, you can lose Dylan Carlson and make that be the canary in the coal mine. Be like, okay, my guys are all about to go, right? And then hope that by the end of the half round or the round that it takes to get to you, you don't lose all four.
This is another pro Reds take. I must just love the Reds secretly. I think Nick Senzel is one of the most underrated, undervalued players in the entire pool right now. I think it is reflected in the projection. You're getting power, you're getting speed, getting a decent projected batting average, but I think there's a great chance of Nick Senzel coming in quite a bit higher than his batting average. I mean, we're under 20% in the shortened season. He struck out 24.4% of the time in his debut. He has a good idea what the zone is, yeah. And you're talking about a guy that had a 55 grade hit tool, according to Fangraphs, going into 2019 with a future 70. That's the kind of profile that wildly exceeds batting average projections. I just like that he can do a little bit of everything as well. And the cost is so good.
Under the hood, he made better swing decisions. He swung less overall, but he swung it more at pitches in the zone and less at pitches outside of the zone. And those are the kind of under hood process numbers that lead to a reduction in strikeout rate, but also sort of support it, right? They tell you he was doing the right things. It wasn't just he struck out one time less in a game, and that changed the whole sample. You know, this is more like no, he had a better sense of what was going on in the zone in 2020 than he did in 2019. An oft injured player like this putting it together in the third year wouldn't surprise me at all. And the projections, the reason I named all those guys is they're all projected for basically $7 of value in a 15 team league. So it's kind of hard for me to be like, as much as I like Carlson, I like Kent Senzel a lot, and like I kind of like Raimel Tapia. Like as much as I don't like Raimel Tapia, there's a lot of things speaking for him. It's not necessarily all his own making. Like just like playing in Coors, and then finally I think having a full time job, but also having cut his strikeout rate and still showing that speed. I think this could be the opportunity for him to hit 10 homers, hit 280 to 290, and now steal 30 bases. Slightly different shape than the guys around him, but also maybe more interesting because of the stolen base addition that he brings. I like all those guys in that group, and I don't like any so much more than the rest that I'll spend the extra $3 or $4 or spend the extra round on it.
I think kind of bridging the gap between Senzel, where he's going right now, in the 280s, like that's going to go up. He's going to creep up. People are going to just keep looking at that profile, and they're going to get more and more excited about having him. So if he jumps 50 spots or even 75 spots in ADP going into the final weekend of drafts, that wouldn't surprise me. I don't think you're actually even reaching that much if you take him at pick 200 or somewhere close to that spot. There's a lot of accumulators jammed in between. A lot of guys that are kind of either low average, big power guys or kind of balanced, I want to say like Adam Eaton types, even though Adam Eaton himself is going a little bit later than this range now, but that's usually where players like Eaton go. The double-double guys, 10-plus homers, 10-plus steals, an everyday job. I think Brandon Nimmo maybe kind of fits into that description a bit. Andrew Benintendi has fallen into that group. I mean, Benintendi, look, as much as he disappointed everybody in the shortened season, he barely played. And I know that my previous expectations that he could maybe be the next Yelich were a ceiling that's probably unfair to put on him. That's just an error in my judgment. That doesn't mean that he's without value at this point, because even if Andrew Benintendi just levels out and the player he was in 2019 is his true baseline, that was 266, 13 homers, 10 steals, 72 runs, and 68 RBIs. Outside the top 200, you're perfectly fine with that, and there's room for more. There's a chance he bounces back and either gets back into the 20 steal range, or maybe he gets back to 20 homers. He had 20 homers way back in 2017, so I'm definitely giving him a pass on an injury-shortened season. 14 games in 2020 from Andrew Benintendi. You could pretty much just throw it all completely out.
Yeah, I think he fits in that sort of Austin Meadows-y group of like guys where the projected bounce back they're young enough where I can believe the projected bounce back. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't want to depend on a projected bounce back from a 32-year-old or a 33-year-old. That we've cited that research a lot, but I don't think it's a good idea. That's too far along the bell curve. But when a guy has a down year in before he turns 30, you know, 26 to 30, yes, 26 to 30 is post peak, but it's also not like way down the stepladder. You know what I mean? It's like they should be able to return to 80% of their peak or 90% of their peak, provided they're healthy. So, yeah, I Benintendi's one of the players that the Bat X likes better than Steamer relatively the most. So, you know, Benintendi's going to be on my list of potential sleepers, potential value picks. And I think he belongs there in the same way as Mitch Haniger belongs there.
Yeah, Haniger makes a lot of sense. Lineup position is going to be good. You're not worried about playing time now that he's completely healthy again. It sounds like he goes into spring training with a clean bill of health. We had Corey Brock, he covers the Mariners for The Athletic, on Fantasy Baseball in 15 on Monday morning. And that was the first question Al asked him. You know, can we expect Mitch Haniger to enter the season healthy? And at this point, that appears to be the case too. So I'm with you on Haniger being very logical for the volume alone, where he's been going right now. What are you doing with Joey Gallo this year? You know, he's at the earlier part of the range that we're talking about. ADP is about 160 since the start of January. I think he fits into our group of players that you got to do something a bit different to build around, but are you generally excited to get Gallo there? And we know that comes with having to make some preparations to get a little extra batting average to offset it, but do you think he's generally undervalued at his current ADP?
He must be. He's a first pager by projections. I had to click back a couple. I was like, where's Joey Gallo? I don't think that he's actually, you know, somebody's making some reference to, you know, in my article, the comments or on Twitter or something saying like, oh, Joey Gallo, better watch out. But like, that's not how I think of Joey Gallo's skill set. I think of a guy who hits the ball really far and really hard and has the best barrel rates in baseball since he got in. Like they could call it the Gallo rate at this point, but it's all about strikeouts to me and batting average. So it's just about whether you can fit him on your team. Are you punting batting average? Are you going to mitigate it? If you're in a shallower league, I would suggest mitigating it. I think that you could probably put together a string of three or four guys hitting 290 plus to mitigate him. But it will take that. And that's why in deeper leagues, if you pick Gallo, I think you have to punt batting average. I think it's that strong of an effect by himself. Like imagine you're in an AL-only league and you buy Joey Gallo. Then you have to buy three or four more guys that hit 290 just to offset the difference between your league average batting average. How many guys like that exist in the American League?
I think the cool thing, though, about where Gallo's going right now is that you can find out if you have the batting average foundation first. You know, you can use him as a way to make up that ground if you go average heavy and maybe you get your speed and average together. You go, yeah, you know, I don't really have anybody on this team who's going to easily hit 30 home runs. Oh, well, I've got Gallo. And if you have enough batting average, you get enough padding, you're not giving that up. If you have two or three guys who are in the 280, 290 range, you're totally fine. If you only have like one guy that's projected to be really good batting average, then you're going to be more potentially like middle of the pack, or the rest of your roster will ultimately determine where you go in that category. But I mean, I remember before DJ LeMahieu was really good, just a couple of years ago when Joey Gallo was more expensive and LeMahieu was even, I think, cheaper than Gallo at the time, our friend Todd Zola all the time would just say, if you put those two guys together, you're basically going to get 25 homers from each of those roster spots with elite run production and a batting average that projects out to be about 250 or 260. And that's perfectly fine when the average cost is like a seventh round pick. And if you think about where they go now, it kind of, it's moved around, but it still works.
It's a soft 250 or 260, though, because you are not allowed to make any more Gallo mistakes. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, sure, those two balance out, but then you can't go lower than 250. Everybody else has to be above 250.
Yeah, you don't want to have the risk of too much of their weight to take away the advantage you got from LeMahieu.
So, yes, that can work, but I personally feel like I would want to have two or three bats to mitigate Joey Gallo, not just one. I don't think it would be quite enough, just because I don't think you win the league with that batting average. But it's doable in certain leagues, and it doesn't have to necessarily be a bunch of guys who hit 330, because there aren't those guys. But if you took, like, who are some guys that we can think of? Brantley is the first guy who comes to mind.
Brantley is one that you'd get like right before you make that pick, too. I would say if you had Jeff McNeil in your foundation, if you took one of the elite bats like Soto up top, if you had him
Charlie
already.
Charlie Blackmon is cheap.
Blackmon is relatively cheap for batting average this year. He definitely helps.
So if you started out with like Juan Soto or Mike Trout, if you started out with one of those three and then you mm-hmm. added one of like Charlie Blackmon or Jeff McNeil or Michael Brantley as your second outfielder, then I think Gallo would be a really good third outfielder, actually.
And the cool thing about this is you could still just be fine not getting Gallo. You could end up with Miguel Sano. I think that's a very similar sort of profile. So I just think this is more of a decision tree sort of route that you want to have ready if you need it. You know, if you've built up enough average, you're light on power, I think you can justify Gallo or Miguel Sano at their respective prices, but that's the type of roadmap you should be following if you're going to do that.
And keeping your batting average high does make these guys more valuable later. Keeping your batting average high means that you can pick Jock Peterson, you can pick Ian Happ, you can pick Justin Upton, you can pick Kyle Lewis, and you don't have to worry about their batting average projection. You know?
Yeah.
That's definitely an argument for keeping your batting average high as long as you can at the beginning of the draft.
Some other interesting players in this range are prospects, guys that haven't even debuted yet, too. Alex Kirilloff, we saw his debut in the playoffs, but he hasn't played in a regular season game yet. I look at where he's going. ADP's 266 since January 1st. That puts him in a cluster with Mitch Haniger, who we talked about earlier, with Mark Canha, who's one of the most difficult players in the pool for me to figure out, even though he's not expensive, so it's okay if I can't completely figure him out. But you have Yasiel Puig, who needs a team, John Birdie, who I run away from at every turn, and he's faster than me, so he could catch me every time. Garrett Hampson, who I would take instead of Birdie because he's in Colorado, Canha, and then Kirilloff. It's a weird, weird cluster, but
that is really weird.
I look at Kirilloff as a type of player that you can have one or two players like him. Like if you think about what it costs for Dylan Carlson, like it's nice to have the exposure to the big leagues that Carlson got last season. At the same time, if I can get the high risk, high reward sort of pick 100 spots later in Alex Kirilloff, I'm tempted to just wait and go after Kirilloff instead. And I say that knowing that Kirilloff's probably not going to steal bases and Dylan Carlson probably will. But just from a relative risk versus price standpoint, are you more comfortable with Kirilloff and players like him in the late 200s, early 300s than you are with Carlson up where we're passing on the Brantleys and those types of players to get him?
That's the general point I was trying to make with that grouping, right? It's like that Tapia, Lewis, you know, Carlson grouping is like, you know, these players all have similar risk and similar opportunity to beat their projections and be more productive than their projections suggest. So, you know, why pay the most for this group? I think Kirilloff, you can put him in that group. I think he'd be like the last one in the group. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Just because Tapia is going to probably steal more bases. Carlson's probably going to do a more balanced line. Lewis had great, great, great batted ball stats. you know, there's a little bit more of a strong argument for each of those other young players to keep them above above Kirilov. But I think I'd be okay with putting him in there. I wonder how big we want to make this tent, though, because there's obviously between Kirilov and Carlson, Carlson being the most expensive of this potential group we're putting together, and Kirilov being the least expensive, that there's different sort of machinations, different risks and rewards. So would you include in that group someone like Christian Pache, or is he so much more risky that he's more of a flyer and a bench piece?
I see Pache as more of a flyer. I think he's fantasy-wise short-term, actually, again, bring back Adam Eaton, kind of like that sort of player where he might exceed some expectations with power. I think speed's going to be his best fantasy asset. He's probably stuck in the bottom third of the Braves lineup all season. But one of my favorite players in the pool has been stuck in the bottom third of the lineup and done a lot of damage as a young player, and it's Victor Robles, right? And I think with Pache, we talked about him when we were looking at the top 100 rankings that Keith Law just put out, and I might have overlooked how good Pache was in 2019 at AA for a 20-year-old. You know, I think it's easy to get caught up in something like 8-for-19 as a base stealer and go, oh, that's disappointing. He got caught more than he was successful stealing bases.
Mm-hmm.
And that might even blind you from the fact that he hit 11 home runs. Christian Pache hit more home runs in AA as a 20-year-old than he hit at every other minor league level the previous three seasons combined. That's a pretty interesting breakout for a guy who's a gold glove defender in center field, which locks in playing time. I mean, the projections are pretty kind to him. 260, 308, 413. 308's a tick low, but 14 homers, 10 steals. Isn't that pretty similar to the Dylan Carlson projection we were just talking about a few minutes ago?
I guess so. Slightly different shape. More strikeouts, fewer walks, less power. But it's funny how he gets there. And it kind of almost like a low-rent Buxton. I get a bit of a low-rent Buxton feeling. I think that with Pache, you look also, the first 2 years he played pro ball, he didn't hit a homer.
Right, but he was 17 and probably rail thin, right? He's not very big currently. He's still,
right,
still kind of adding to the frame at this point.
Well, all right. I mean, maybe he belongs there along Kirilov, or maybe we make a second group. And we make a second group of like, hey, these guys are, you know, a little bit more risky, but also kind of are in a similar group. If we make a second group, we can put Kirilov in it. We can put Pache in it. I think I would say I'd personally put Sam Hilliard in there. Maybe somebody like DJ Stewart. They're slightly different ages and shapes and stuff, but definitely some risk. But DJ Stewart has the great Statcast numbers. Sam Hilliard has some Statcast numbers going for him. The strikeout rate makes him risky, but now looks like hopefully, like, you know, going to play a lot. So, you know, all four of those guys, I think, are, you know, ideal for me. Like, I would love to put them on my bench, you know, and just be like, all right, I'm going to put you on my bench for the first 2 weeks and see how often you get played. Are you a 4 times a weeker, a 5 times a weeker, or 7 times a weeker, you know? And that'll be as important to me to keeping me on my roster as anything they're doing results wise in the field.
So here's how my brain works. Leody Taveras got up last year in Texas, and their outfield's a bit more crowded now than it was at the end of the season, but I think they still see him as their center fielder of the long-term future. I think he's got every opportunity to take the job, keep the job, and just be the guy all year in 2021.
And I'm not going to touch him.
I can't at the price. There's a 200 there's a 200 pick difference between Leody Taveras and Christian Pache in ADP. They're basically the same guy based on projections. And when you look at what Pache did at AA compared to what Taveras did at AA, both guys really young for their levels, it's really easy to choose Pache based on that track record. To me, that matters more than Taveras getting 33 games in the big leagues last season, whereas Pache got 2 plus the playoffs, right? Like, it's easy to look at Taveras and just go, oh, well, he did it a little bit in the big leagues. I don't think he was there long enough for that experience to make that much of a difference.
Without that big league, like, without that big league production, like, if you even gave him 3 homers instead of 4, I would posit that his power projections might be even worse than Pache's, because Leody Taveras had years where he didn't hit a homer, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, not quite. He had one in all of 2016, but he had, you know, he has similar really light ISOs in his past, and he's projected for a certain amount of power just because he hit four homers last year, as far as I can see, because 2018 A ball, 0.086 ISO, 2019 A ball, 0.082 ISO, double A 2019, 0.110 ISO. Then he comes up, has a 33 game sample where he's a 0.168 ISO in the major leagues. Now he's projected to be 143 ISO. Like, right?
Doesn't quite add up. Also, that park is not looking like a good place to hit for power at all. So, like he might put the ball in play a lot more than he did as a rookie. I think that's a reasonable bet. But he might be the kind of guy that gets the bat knocked out of his hands for a little while, even though the exit velo numbers were okay last year. 88.9 is not bad. That's not any sort of blue ink alarming sign.
It's not as bad as Oscar Mercado was when we should have known.
Right. I look at that and I go, wow, they're a little crowded in the outfield. They've sort of punted on outfield defense before. If he falls on his face, he's going down to AAA. Because Leody Taveras didn't play at AAA. He spent a half season at AA and then debuted last year. So Pache, to me, can struggle a bit at the plate, and because of his glove, just be the eight hitter, be the nine hitter if we have the universal DH, and just stay up in Atlanta all year and put up pretty decent counting stats just by virtue of being there all season.
Yeah, yeah. And just to like drive your point home, I think if I just sometimes it's useful to kind of just like try to like clear your mind and then just be like, I'm not looking at any numbers right now. What group does he belong in? And I would say that Leody Taveras belongs in the second group that we were building.
Yeah, he belongs in the Pache group. Yeah. Like, there's no doubt about that. And ADP has them miles apart from each other for reasons that I can't fully understand. Minor league stolen bases, I guess. I mean, you see some pretty nice totals from Taveras, and he might be that kind of player in the big leagues, but I think we're assuming a little bit too much if we're taking him just inside the top 200. I think Pache is your perfect eat this, not that alternative. You want that young player that could get a lot better and provide a lot of value. Pache, where he's going, makes much more sense at this point. We've got fallen prospects kind of sprinkled in here. I mean, the guy that I think we got to talk about before we go is Jared Kelnick, because he belongs in the first group. He's not quite as expensive as Dylan Carlson just yet. He hasn't debuted. The Mariners are at least going to wait a couple of weeks to bring him up because service time's a big deal and Kelnick's going to be a superstar by most accounts. Are you comfortable with Jared Kelnick where he's going right now? Because you're not paying the Carlson price. You're paying more like a pick 200 sort of pick. And guys in that range are a little more risky as a group. I mean, you got Randall Grichuk on the brink of losing some playing time. Victor Reyes going a little earlier. I think he's toolsy and interesting, but obviously has some downside. Chris Taylor, JD Davis, Austin Hayes. Like, I think this is a pretty nice spot to take that first risk. I think it's a fair price for the payoff you could get.
Yeah. You know, he's a weird one where the ceiling belongs in the first group, I fundamentally believe, because I think he's a top five prospect in the game, right? Mm-hmm. So the ceiling belongs in that first group of youngsters we were putting together. The floor belongs in the second group. Because the floor is he doesn't come up for the first 2 weeks and then maybe he gets hurt in the minor leagues and he's not up for another 2 or 3 weeks, or maybe he struggles a little bit at first and they say, oh, we just need more time. And, you know, they start playing the service time games and then all of a sudden he's not up till July. And then if he comes up and struggles at all, then maybe they send him back. You know what I mean? Like, we've seen this before, like Joe Adele, you know, we've seen this. Kellen doesn't quite have the same strikeout rate, situation that Adele did, but we've seen this thing before. I don't, where he's going right now, I feel okay with saying, okay, I'll take him now and I can get somebody as good as Austin Hayes in the next round if I feel nervous. But what I also think is that players like this, top five type prospects, get a lot of helium as draft season goes on. And I normally find that they're priced too high for me.
Right. If Kelnick gets close to Dylan Carlson's ADP by the end of March, especially in high stakes leagues, like that's
take Dylan Carlson.
Right. Take Carlson. He's going to be up right away and you're not stuck waiting and risking the possibility of waiting a month or 6 weeks. It could be 2 weeks because I don't think he needs to prove a whole lot to be ready, but like Vlad got hurt. The Jays were going to wait. Vlad hurt his quad or his hamstring. We had to wait a couple extra weeks. It's very frustrating to be in that spot. And I think when you also look at this, Wander Franco has an ADP that's almost 100 picks later than Jared Kelnick right now. It's the same kind of problem. I think if I'm going to choose one, I'm going to take Franco.
You see the place he's going to play, but then you don't see the Willy Adames trade coming either right before it happens. You know?
Well, yeah, and if the Adames trade happens in the next couple of weeks or this week.
Oh, then it'll blow up.
Franco's ADP goes up 100 spots immediately. And maybe 150 by the time we get to late March. Maybe he's the guy that's chasing Dylan Carlson in terms of where people are actually going to take him. But I'm okay with having one guy like Kelnick, one guy like Franco. You can't have more than that in redraft because it will absolutely ruin you waiting for those guys to come up. You'll want to wait longer than you should to drop them if they don't get the call right away. It is a miserable experience. It's fun on draft day, and then it's miserable every Sunday for the first 4 to 6 Sundays while you sit there and cut somebody else instead and leave your roster playing short all season long. Anybody else in the outfield grabbing your attention, either late flyers, bounce back candidates, really any type of outfielder that you feel like we should bring up?
I just wanted to bring up that 650 OPS line. That's kind of, you need to be able to put up better than 650 OPS to really keep your regular job in the big leagues. Miles Straw and Victor Reyes and Leody Taveras are all, at that 650 level. One, two, or three of these guys will lose their jobs this year. And so therefore put them in a group. I guess this is the grouping podcast. Put them in a group. And take the cheapest one, you know. You can't not take them because steals are that rare. So, I think we had it down to about 18 players that are going to have better than a 650 OPS and more than 15 steals. I don't even know if you can populate your whole team with enough steals just based on picking from those 18 players. So we're all going to have some of these guys on our list and you just have to pick the right one. I don't know. I can't really speak to any of them being amazing. Straw, they're all very similar, just no power, not much patience and a lot of speed. I think maybe the Astros are the most stuck with Straw.
I think they're going to do something to not have to play him very often.
I keep thinking that they're going to sign JBJ, dude.
Makes sense based on their needs. Yeah.
But it hasn't happened yet. Nick Solak shows up, but we've talked about him a fair amount. Sam Hilliard, I just want to give some love to him. I think that even with that batting average as a Coors player, even with that batting average and strikeout rate as a Coors player, he can survive, and he's a very nice option to have on your bench if you have any sort of flexibility when to play and when not. I feel like that on-off switch is pretty easy to figure out. It's not something you have to bang your head. Is he playing a course this week? Okay, then you can play him. And then I have some love for Gregory Polanco. He's in that. He's barely in that window when it comes to being young enough that you can believe the projected bounce back. So 29 years old, projected for 24 homers and 10 stolen bases by the Bat X. Not with a great batting average, but he's also had a bunch of years with a .250 batting average. I think he could maybe get back to that level. So, Gregory Polanco is another one of those guys who's ending up on my teams.
Yeah, going really late. If it doesn't work out, he's an easy drop. But I think there's a good chance you end up pretty happy with him as one of your last picks with an ADP just outside the top 450 right now. Hopefully we got to all the outfielders that you're interested in. If we didn't, drop us a line, ratesandbarrels@theathletic.com. On Twitter, he's at Enosaris. I'm at Derek Van Riper. If you want to check out our rankings, you can check out Eno's pitching rankings. You can check out all the rankings I put out. Theathletic.com/ratesandbarrels gets you a subscription for just $3.99 a month to start. It's the best deal we have going right now. Thank you to the many of you who've taken the time to subscribe. If you got a minute to give us a nice rating and review, we'd appreciate that. If you're watching us on YouTube, welcome. Hit the subscribe button. Hit the like button on the video, even though it's really mostly just us staring into the camera and making weird faces. We really appreciate those of you who've jumped on board and found our podcast that way. That is going to wrap things up for this episode of Rates and Barrels. We are back with you on Wednesday.
Thanks for listening.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.